Welcome back to What's at Risk. I'm Mike Christian. It has been a decade since John Bogle's Common Sense on Mutual Funds was first published. His bestseller examined the fundamentals of mutual fund investing in turbulent market environments and offered valuable guidance for building investment portfolios. Since the first edition was published in 1999, much has changed and changed radically in the financial landscape, and no one is more aware of this than mutual fund pioneer John C. Bogle. After decades of unprecedented growth in the U.S. stock market, over the past 10 years we've experienced major bear markets, and most significantly, the economic crisis of 2007 to 2009, which wreaked havoc on the economy at large. But despite significant turmoil, the investment principles Bogle wrote about in 1999 have stood the test of time. Hugely important to investors and for the industry when it originally published in 1999, when the market was soaring. The passage of time has been kind to the book by proving Bogle's precepts absolutely correct. This new edition is an important roadmap for investors as they seek a way forward. Bogle takes a critical look at the mutual fund industry and helps investors navigate their way through the staggering array of investment alternatives that are available to them. In a rising market, costs and taxes and the problems of size are easily overlooked. Bogle reminds us of the losses to our portfolios from our lack of diligence. On Wall Street. John C. Bogle is the founder of the Vanguard Group and president of the Bogle Financial Markets Research Center. He created Vanguard in 1974 and served as chairman and chief executive until 1996 and senior chairman until 2000. The Vanguard Group is one of the two largest mutual fund organizations in the world. In 2004, Time magazine named Mr. Bogle as one of the world's 100 most powerful and influential people. An institutional investor presented him with its Lifetime Achievement Award. In 1999, Fortune designated him as one of the investment industry's four investment giants of the 20th century.
We're with John C. Bogle, the founder of Vanguard Mutual Fund Group and the author of Common Sense on Mutual Funds. It's been over a decade since the first edition of Common Sense was first published. Have the conclusions you made about the mutual fund investment industry 10 years ago been borne out over these recent turbulent years?
Well, the answer to that, I think, Mike, is an unequivocal yes and no.
Way to be definitive.
And what I've tried to do to deal with that in the new edition is I've updated all the data in red so you can see what's the original book. We didn't change a word from the original book, but we updated it. And there's also a fair amount of editorial comment about things that require comment. So the answer really is yes and no, but it's yes in terms of my first objective in writing the book, which is to help investors to become more successful in their investment programs. And there I talked about the fact that after two decades of fantastic returns, don't expect more in the recent decade. I suggest the returns might be as low as 3-5% or even negative, and that certainly has been borne out. I talked about the need for a balanced program in terms of asset allocation with some stocks and some bonds, and that has clearly been borne out. I talked about the value of low cost in funds. That's been borne out. I talked about the value of tax efficiency. That warning was also a good one. And I also talked about not chasing winners. We like to, in the fund business, we like to promote our hottest funds, and of course, as soon as they get promoted enough, they get cold. And so if you chase the winners, everything reverts to the mean in the financial markets. That is to say, the above-average funds go down to average or below, and the below-average funds go back to average or above, clearly demonstrated in the past decade, even more than the preceding decade, obviously. Not obviously, but as it happens, And so all that advice was really good advice. So I'd give myself a pretty good grade, I mean, let's say a 95 on the investment advice. But the book had a second objective, and here's where the no comes in. The second objective was to chart a course for the mutual fund industry. And there I failed. I said we've got to get away from the notion that funds should be traded like stocks. And in the face of what happened in the past decade is the fastest growing component of the entire industry has been mutual funds that are designed to be traded like stocks. They're called exchange-traded funds. And it's the mutual fund industry has let down the faith of investors. Their high turnover has remained. The dominance of the industry philosophy, which I suggested move from salesmanship to stewardship and from marketing to management, changed only for the worse. So I'd give myself pretty close to a zero on having the changes that I think this industry needs be implemented during the decade. So I suppose if I got batted almost 1,000 on the investment side and a zero on the industry side, I could give myself a 500, which is not all that bad when you think that even Ted Williams only had 406, maybe.
Right. And maybe only 340 lifetime, right? So that brings up a couple of follow-up questions. So agency ownership of stocks really has increased dramatically over the last 10 years, right?
Very much so.
I think it accounts for, 65 to 70%.
It's actually very close to 70%. And it's a trend that goes back actually 50 years, but it's certainly continued and maybe even accelerated a bit during the last 10 years.
So your thoughts are that the responsibility really that should come with agency ownership of stocks hasn't necessarily been there in the mutual fund industry?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're a little more generous with the way you express it than I would.
I'm trying to be nice here.
Yeah, the mutual fund agents have let down their mutual fund shareholder principals. Principals, not L-E-S, but A-L-S, the mutual fund owners. And agency law basically is based on something that we all read in the Bible a long time ago. No man can serve two masters. And yet something like 30 out of the 40 largest mutual fund complexes are owned by financial conglomerates, or even publicly owned, where there's a whole other set of shareholders to whom the managers have, I admit it, a fiduciary duty. We have got fiduciary duty to the management company shareholders and fiduciary duty to the fund shareholders, and it's the latter that's got lost in the shuffle because it's the former, the management company, that is paying all these executives. They collect the management fees, and the mutual fund investors get what's left. As I've often said, the fund investor feeds at the bottom of the food chain. He gets paid only after everybody else.
You also brought up ETFs or exchange-traded funds. What are your thoughts about those versus mutual funds? I mean, they are a form of a mutual fund, but they are traded, obviously, more actively.
Yeah, I mean, you're really contrasting mutual funds that you can only trade once a day, which might seem to some of us quite ample. Imagine trading
should
a mutual
be.
Fund once a day. To mutual funds that, in the words of the ad for the largest ETF, the SPDR, Standard & Poor's Depository Receipt, is now you can trade the S&P 500 stock index all day long in real time. And I just got to tell you, what kind of a nut would want to do that? Trade the S&P 500 all day long in real time? And when you think about the ETF, it really doesn't comport with normal human logic. And yet it's the booming part of the industry because it gives people the idea that they can make money during the day. Think about that. I mean, and I know it's absurd.
Yeah, it certainly goes against the buy and hold sort of mentality of a mutual fund, right?
We've layered on top of that all these crazy, I wish I had a better word for it, varieties of ETFs because you can index just about everything. They're pretty much all index funds. And you know, there are some that will leverage your investment. So you'll do twice as well as the market if it goes up and twice as badly if it goes down. But for those who think it's going down, we have reverse leverage funds where you can do two or three times better than the market if you bet it's going down, and that bet, too, is leveraged. And we have very narrow industry groups that are thrown out there. I have no objection to there's nothing the matter with an ETF that you buy and hold that owns the S&P 500 or owns total stock market index or total bond market index or total international index or total emerging market index. Those are fine. If they're not traded. But out of 800-odd ETFs, maybe 25 of them are these broadly diversified portfolios that I would describe as classic indexing. And that leaves 775 that are engaged in some sort of a speculative bent.
And Vanguard does have ETF funds, right?
We do have ETFs. We have not done any of the crazy ones, I'm happy to tell you. But we still have, and I'm not convinced that we are able to, we have industry sector ETFs that go beyond those, you know, broad market in the ETFs that I mentioned. And I'm not so sure that betting on the financial sector, or betting on the technology sector, or betting on the utility sector, or betting on the manufacturing sector is a very intelligent thing for people to do. I mean, I freely concede that if your biggest investment, let's say you're an employee of Microsoft and have a lot of Microsoft stock, you could buy every index except the technology index, and that would probably be an intelligent thing to do, to reduce your bet on the technology industry, own the financials and the energy and the healthcare and all that, and just skip the technology sector. That's not a stupid thing to do. I'm not sure anybody does it that way, but that's one way they can be used intelligently. So, you know, I've often observed it's like the that famous, I'm not into this myself, and perhaps you're not either, but it's the famous Purdy shotgun, P-U-R-D-Y, supposed to be D-E-Y, supposed to be the best shotgun in the world, made over in merry old England. And it's brilliant for shooting wild game in Africa, but it's also terrific for suicide. And so, you know, I think more people are going to commit suicide with these ETFs than they are going to do an intelligent thing with them.
You know, your comments there just bring up another point, and I know it's made in your book on asset allocation. Do you think we've, as investors, particularly over the last few years, learned the lesson about asset allocation?
Yes, I think we have learned a lesson, but I think it's the wrong lesson. You know, I'm sorry to be so negative about it, but there's a reality here, and that is the ultimate diversifier, the particular diversifier that has the least correlation with the market is gold. And so if you want to spread out your risk, diversify your risk, you add gold to your portfolio. What were people saying 15 or 20 years ago or 10 years ago or 5 years? No one was recommending gold because it hadn't done well. Now gold goes through the roof, and everybody says you need it as a diversifier. However, the reality is it's a form of performance chasing. And you're going to see that in emerging markets. When something does well, I say there's a diversity. And commodities, another good example. I mean, I don't know why people can't get it through their heads that commodities, including gold, have no, and I mention this in the book quite strongly, have no internal rate of return. In other words, the bond has an interest coupon that will ultimately support it. Now, the stock has, or a portfolio of stocks, the stock market has an underlying dividend yield and earnings growth that will support it ultimately, even if you pay too much for it. But there's no similar investment value. Gold or commodities are rank speculation. You're buying something with the hope that somebody will buy it for you for more than you paid for it. There's no better way to describe speculation than that.
It's not enough.
Of short-term speculation has replaced the wisdom of long-term investing as the star of capitalism. A rent-a-stock system has replaced the earlier own-a-stock system. In 2009, the average stock turnover appears to have exceeded 250%. That means it's changed hands 2.5 times, compared to a 78% a decade ago, and 21% barely 30 years ago.
I took your money and your shoes. Now you got the Wall Street blues.
Well, I'm thinking about different stuff now. I'm worried about my retirement suddenly. And I lost my broker. I used to be with Charles Schwab, and now I'm with his brother, Cotton. That joke is so stupid you had to say it back to yourself. We're not paying for that joke.
The momentary illusion of the price of a stock took center stage, replacing the enduring reality of the company's intrinsic value, the discounted value of its future cash flow. Our newly empowered agents ignored the famous warning of Benjamin Graham in The Intelligent Investor that in the short run, the market is a voting machine. In the long run, it is a weighing machine.
Jack's Finance Company.
Hello, sir.
What do you want, a loan?
Yes, but I just know you won't be able to help me.
Okay, well, thanks for calling.
No, wait. Please don't hang up.
You don't sound like a good risk to me, Bunky.
You don't understand. I'm desperate.
Oh, I understand. Knowing our interest rates, you gotta be desperate calling Ajax Finance.
Please help me.
Have a little pride.
Well, I used to be the president of a big company.
Sure you were.
No, really.
What big company?
Well, to tell you the truth, it was the Ajax...
You're kidding! I'm sitting at your old desk right now, Frank. Small world, huh?
It's a rotten world, that's what it is. Wasn't long ago I was sitting at that desk making big money.
We'd have been happy to give you a loan then, Frank.
Talk about dirty, rotten, filthy deals.
The financial sector became the driving force in the U.S. economy. During the past decade, revenues of stock exchange firms rose to an estimated $375 billion from $200 billion, and mutual fund fees and expenses rose to nearly $100 billion from $47 billion. The higher these costs, of course, the lower the returns to investors as a group. Alas, in this Alice in Wonderland world of the financial markets, the investor feeds at the bottom of the food chain. All of this speculative market activity and costly marketing activity seem to lead to institutional money managers to ignore the realities that drove the balance sheets and income statements of the companies held in their portfolios. A striking failure of professional security analysis. Financial engineering was left to run rampant, and anything goes seemed to be the rule in the quest to meet earnings guidance. The late Robert Bartley got it right when he wrote in the American Spectator, "True profits are represented by cash, a fact, rather than reported profit, an opinion."
Run, 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 take a deck or two. Run, 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 jib to death in you. Tell you what to do.
We're back with John C. Bogle, the author of Common Sense on Mutual Funds.
You mentioned leveraged ETFs a while ago. Let's just talk about leverage for a second. We certainly, over the last 10 years, credit default swaps, this sort of shadow market that was there that none of us as, you know, as sort of part-time investors really knew about, you know, led to what I would perceive as market manipulation, this sort of financial engineering that was going on. Do you think we're through that? Do you think, you know, we're the impact of that is finally starting to wane?
I think that things like collateralized debt obligations were, you know, it just destroys the link between the borrower and the lender. So the lender who's going to get rid of the mortgage as soon as he gets it couldn't care less about the credit of the borrower. I mean, it's so fundamental to how the system should work, and then that broke down. And credit default swaps have obviously failed. But those specialized investment vehicles, those awful things that Citigroup had, I think, $28 billion, basically, of the money market funds with the principal guaranteed by the bank. They had an automatic put that Bob Rubin, the chairman of the Citibank Executive Committee and the former Secretary of the Treasury, had never heard of them. Had never heard of them. It's only $30 billion, Bob. Okay. And those things will, I think, not come back. People realize that they're just marketing devices that carry a lot more risk than you realize at first impression. But something new will come back. Something new and different, unless we do something about it. And because Wall Street's creativity is what makes Wall Street rich. Think of something new, have it catch on, buy a new product, and innovate, innovate, innovate. But the problem is the innovation is for the benefit of Wall Street, and not for the benefit of the buyers of the securities.
So on that note, your last chapter in your book is called On Spirit, and it talks about entrepreneurship, which of course includes innovation and leadership and, you know, human beings and the emotion of investing. What do you think about entrepreneurship in America today? Because that's where value is really created, right?
I think what I really have to do is give it a split decision. Entrepreneurship that creates value for American consumers is a terrific, wonderful thing. And it eventually, you know, when you create a valuable product or services, you can make a lot of money yourself. And I say, more power to you. You're adding value to society. Entrepreneurship in the financial area means creating these wild products that cost a lot of money and therefore subtract value from society. The financial system subtracts value from the American economy because people are trading these instruments back and forth with one another, and that's an even trade. You know, the buyer is either smart or dumb, and the seller the reverse. But there's that croupier in the middle that we call Wall Street. It's like what there is in Las Vegas. So innovation in the financial business is done for the wrong reasons, and entrepreneurship just goes too far. It gets into financial buccaneering, where prudent stewardship, trusteeship, words like fiduciary duty have been pushed aside in the name of entrepreneurship and innovation. And that has been demonstrably and definitively bad for American investors.
Are you bullish about the future of the mutual fund industry?
Only if it changes. And one thing that worries me, concerns me, is clearly the Vanguard model in which we serve on, don't need to promote it, but in which we serve only one master, the fund shareholders, because our fund shareholders actually own the management company. We're a mutual company and we operate at cost. And this saves our shareholders, you know, the better part of $10 billion per year. Because our costs run about, let's say, 0.25% or less, where the industry runs around 1.25%. 1% on that $1.3 trillion we manage is a $10 billion refund per year. Yet nobody is copying it. I picked the name Vanguard for the firm because I thought we were the leader in a new trend. And we have, 35 years later, we have yet to find our first follower because people are in this business to make money for themselves. I feel very good about the entrepreneurship we did. You know, when you talk about innovation, I think you can say the money market fund was a great innovation of the last era. I think you can say the index fund, fairly, was a great innovation. I think you can say the defined maturity bond fund, you know, have picked long, intermediate, or short, and don't try and manage out of one to the other. It was a great idea. I think the tax-managed series of mutual funds, run them as if shareholders pay taxes, which, of course, they do. That was another great innovation. And four of those innovations are ours. We did not innovate the money market fund. Those are the four contributing ones. I don't see much else that contributed, although Paul Volcker, who knows more about these things than I do, says he can think of an innovation that contributed more to American society, and that is the ATM, the automatic teller machine. And I'll give him that.
There you go. Any final common sense tips for the listeners, John?
No, the common sense is just don't let your behavior overwhelm your logic. Don't let emotion overcome your reason. We are facing very tough times. Face that in this country. Don't deny it. And try and set yourself up. You've got to, if you want to have a retirement income, one way to assure you won't have it is not to save. So you have to save. And that balance between more aggressive investing in common stocks and more conservative investing in bonds is the eternal challenge. And I'd say facing what's coming up, we're looking at a decade where I'm quite confident stock returns will be higher than bond returns. The probabilities are strong for that. But we have to have investors who think about not only the probabilities, but the consequences if they're wrong. So that leads me to say that let's be a little bit careful as we move ahead today. Certainly not abandoning stocks, but maybe no more and perhaps a little bit less than you would otherwise think you should have.
Yeah, it's great advice. We've been speaking with John Bogle, the founder of the Vanguard Mutual Fund Group. John, is there a website for you and your books?
I have my e-blog. It's called an e-blog instead of a blog because e-blog is an anagram for Bogle. How about that?
There we go.
It's www.johncbogle.com.
We had it all in the palm of our hand, a new hope, a new dream. of the past. To build something of value, build something to last.
That's it for this week's edition of What's at Risk. I'd like to thank our very special guest tonight, Christine Porath, the author of The Cost of Bad Behavior, and John C. Bogle, the founder of the Vanguard Group and the author of Common Sense on Mutual Funds. I'd like to thank our producer, Johnny Pfister of Ringo Studio, and our associate producer, Scott Cooper. We're interested in what you're thinking about. Send us an email at whatsatrisk@risk-strategies.com and let us know what's on your mind.
For podcasts of What's at Risk, go to wbz.com/risk. You've been listening to What's at Risk, heard every Saturday night on WBZ News Radio 1030 and streaming on wbz.com.
Run the risk, or you'll never know for sure.
When your company is considering risk management and consultative support for your business insurance, make the right choice and call Risk Strategies Company. With offices in Massachusetts, New York, San Francisco, Los Angeles, and Irvine, California, Chicago, and Providence, Risk Strategies Company takes a team approach to protecting your assets efficiently and cost-effectively. By offering a wide range of services and capabilities, Risk Strategies Company brings the highest level of expertise to clients in all areas of insurance and risk management, delivering insurance solutions, extensive carrier relationships and marketing expertise, claim advocacy, loss control safety management, health and welfare coverage, life and executive compensation plans, personal insurance lines, and surety. For the most comprehensive risk management and insurance coverage for your business, depend on Risk Strategies Company. Learn more at risk-strategies.com or call 617-330-5700. 617-330-5700.